If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. Squirty guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They don't know our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, Thursday night, actually it'd be Friday morning, I sort of stay up late, so I keep unusual hours. Anyway, I sometimes enjoy one of these early morning or late night movies that you see on TV. And this was, I believe, on Bravo. I might be wrong, but anyway, where it was isn't perhaps all that important. But it was, I won't exactly say fluffy, but not particularly profound movies. And it was called Deadly Deed, and it was about a will that bequeathed the house for the purposes of to help poor people. And there was a lot of skullduggery by several people at the bank, and a man was murdered. As the plot developed, there were various suspects. Each in turn looked like the good one, the ideal suspect, and in the end turned out not to be. But anyway, the plot's neither here nor there. What I found interesting is that this seemed to be set in the Pacific Northwest, in a relatively small town. Almost all of the cast, all of the characters, were white. Okay, I don't have any problem with that. However, the chief of police in this, I would say, small city or large town, is a bald-headed Negro. Possible? Oh, I don't know. I suppose. Likely? No, I don't think so. Well, then why would, you know, when his deputies and all the other people in the cast, with maybe one other exception, and she was dubious, wasn't quite sure what her race was, but when everybody else in the cast was white, I mean, it's a white town. Why would they do that? Well, you know, it's this absolutely cloying political correctness, or cultural Marxism, or, I mean, to be more blunt about it, it's mind control. Well, what point were they trying to make? Well, several times a white deputy would be saying to him, "Oh, yes, sir," and taking directions and orders from him. Now, the chief of police actually didn't solve the crime. That was one of the female characters and her sidekick who was on the police department. But he was the authority figure. Now, does that correspond with the real world? Maybe it does in some large metropolitan areas where, again, often not because of merit, but you know, to be politically correct, to bend over backwards for minorities—not for us, mind you—but for minorities, the political establishment will put in a Negro police chief. That's happened in Toronto, and you know when you watch these dramas, you have to be aware of the manipulation. I had this talk with a number of people recently, and I'm very pleasantly surprised to see how many people see through a lot of it. In fact, at a gathering not so long ago, somebody told me, how is it that half the couples we see in advertising are mixed-race couples? Well, I don't think it's quite half. But in Canada, I would say, quite a lot, maybe 25%. Well, is that reflecting society? Well, no, it's not. Mixed race couples are about 5% of society. So, if the idea is advertising should in some way reflect the population, I don't really have a problem with that idea. I mean, theoretically, as long as it's not compelled. But it doesn't. So what are they doing? Well, part of what they're doing is they are trying to create, they're trying to sensitize us, or brain tenderize us, for the world they, the globalists, want to create, or what they want to give us. I was at another gathering just the other day, and a woman got up and criticized the lack of non-white people up at the front. Oh, I'm sorry, I know what it was. It was the annual shareholders meeting of a wine company I'm involved with. And the complaint was, oh yeah, it was in the advertising. That was it. We were showing several of the slick TV video ads that are currently running or will be running, and this woman made the observation that over half of Canada are, I forget how she phrased it, the current interim is racialized minorities. They're not. They're people of non-white back race, or more usually referred to as visible minorities or third world immigrants. That's what they are. But okay, she said something like that. But she said they don't reflect in the ads. Are we not going to try to seek their business? Well, the board of directors gave the spokesman for the board of directors gave what I thought was a particularly sad and mealy-mouthed response. The correct response is over half of Canada is not, thank God, yet third world. It's roughly 22%, 78% white or native people, 22% immigrants from the third world. Okay, so her figures are wrong. Although I could understand if you came from parts of Toronto where you might well think half the people you see, and you'd be right, are from the third world. But okay, so her point was, we should have more of those people in our ads. As I say, the response by the spokesman for the board of directors was particularly weak. I would have challenged her on her assertion, first of all. And then I would have said, well, now look, well, obviously we want the widest possible market for our wine. Among the people from the third world, a very large percentage, or a large minority of those people, are Muslims, who technically aren't supposed to drink alcohol. Similarly, Sikhs. Now, I know the Sikhs in British Columbia have a bad reputation for being really heavy boozers, but they're not supposed to. So, if you're going to target your audience, your market, your advertising to a potential market, probably the only significant non-white market that might be persuadable to drink wine are the Chinese. But I thought, while there might have been a glimmer of an idea in the woman's question, let's not forget what she thought was half the Canadian population, but in fact, it's nowhere near that, thank heavens. But nonetheless, let's be more sensible in how we do it. I suppose you might say that's a sign of the times. Well, I failed to do this two nights ago. I'm recording this on Friday the 13th. Two nights ago, I suppose I really should have acknowledged that this was 9/11, or the anniversary. And it is hard to imagine that it's been, on that day, it was 18 years since the planes slammed into the Twin Towers and something hit the Pentagon. The official story is it was a plane. Other people think it was a missile, a cruise missile, perhaps, for reasons that kind of go beyond what we can, effectively discuss tonight. And then the plane that crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. So 18 years, that's a long time. I'll give you a few observations. Well, I guess one thing that almost anybody who was a teenager or an adult back then, and I was an adult, will say in a conversation about 9/11 is they'll want to try to remember where they were, and they'll ask their opposite number, well, where were you? I can tell you, I was in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I had done a meeting at an airport area hotel the night before, and I was flying to Toronto that morning because we'd be conducting a meeting in Toronto that evening with in Kitchener, Ontario, with one of our overseas guests from Germany. And so I was eager to board the plane. Well, at the hotel, I guess the plane would have been leaving around noon. There was already the TV coverage of the impact of these planes on the World Trade Center. I believe it happened around 9:30 in the morning Eastern Time. I was in Winnipeg, so that would be Central Time. And there was some talk about disruption in air travel, but I wasn't going to govern my travel plans on the basis of what was on TV. So the airport wasn't very far away. And I drove to the airport and tried to check in. And I was told all flights had been canceled. What do you mean? Well, by this time, the TV screens were saying that the American government had ordered all planes that were in the air to land at the nearest airport, and no further planes until further notice would be allowed to take off. Because initially, they didn't know had other planes perhaps been hijacked, or were there bombs on the planes? They weren't really sure what they were dealing with. That was what happened. Well, back to the hotel and hastily made arrangements to stay another night. That wasn't the problem, but now I had to try to deal with the meeting that was to take place that night in Kitchener, Ontario, which is about 60 miles from northwest of Toronto. Well, I was supposed to drive our guest up there. He was already in Toronto, staying with other German friends. What was I to do? So I called my good friend and sort of my right-hand man in those days, Wolfgang Müller, and asked, would you drive our guest to Kitchener, and you conduct the meeting. Obviously, I will not be back. Toronto's about 1,000, Winnipeg's about 1,000 miles from Toronto. There's no way I was going to be able to drive in, perhaps at this point, 5 hours, 5 or 6 hours. Anyway, so stayed overnight. And the next night, we were to have a meeting with the same German guest in Toronto. And again, what was I to do? Well, a few flights were resuming, and I was able to get a flight that would get me into Toronto at about 7 o'clock. Now, our meeting was at 8 o'clock. Fortunately, it wasn't too far from the airport. Anyway, again, I called my friend Wolfgang Müller and asked him, would he please be prepared to start the meeting. I hoped I'd be able to be there. As a matter of fact, I was able to rush in, rolled into the meeting about, I think he sort of did a little introduction and killed time for a bit. I rolled in at about 10 minutes after 8 and introduced our guest speaker from Germany, and the meeting went on. And of course, everybody was very eager to know what had happened. How did you get here? Because the word was officially, most flights were still canceled. Okay, so that's my story of, okay, where were you on 9/11? Well, what did I think of 9/11? Well, I don't have a absolutely firm opinion, but from the beginning I had doubts. One of the first things that was reported within a few days was that something like 25% of Americans believed that the wildly pro-Israeli policy of the American government had led to 9/11. It was known within a few hours that the perpetrators were Arabs. Most were actually Saudis. It appeared, and Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility. The terrorist group led by Osama bin Laden claimed responsibility for this. This was his kick at the United States. And a substantial number of people felt that America had been targeted because of something that they could have avoided doing, and that was this blind support for Israel. Now, that line of thinking, of course, left me somewhat divided internally, emotionally. I don't like the idea of giving into terrorism, and I don't like the idea of giving into threats. And I think a lot of Americans and others felt the same way. On the other hand, though, one of the demands of Al-Qaeda was that the United States get out of Arab lands. Well, that's not entirely an unreasonable position. Why was America in where Arab lands? And in fact, they would be much more so in the intervening 18 years since then. Since then, we of course had George Bush's war with Iraq in 2003. The ongoing war in Afghanistan, which is still ongoing, 18 years later. Do you realize that World War II, and we all grew up on stories of World War II and America's bravery and involvements and payback for Pearl Harbor and all of that. Do you realize World War II lasted less than 4 years? They declared war on December 8th, 1941. VE Day was in May 8, 1945, and VJ Day, the surrender of Japan, in August. America was at war for less than 4 years. Canada was at war two years longer, from August 1939 to August 1945. But even that's 6 years. The war in Afghanistan has gone on for 18 years. Now, it's not the high-intensity war with
divisions and divisions and divisions of American troops and so on than World War II was, but still, it's a war, and people die. In fact, as recently as the last few days, another American serviceman was blown up and came back in a body bag. So, thinking back to 9/11, what were my doubts? Well, first doubt I had was what didn't happen. You know, as I began to think about it, react, get information, and so on, what didn't happen? Well, nothing further happened. There was this dramatic attack, coordinated. Two planes slam into the two Twin Towers. Another plane or something slams into the Pentagon. Another plane, something happens, is diverted or whatever, and crashes in a field in Pennsylvania. Okay. The attack on the Twin Towers certainly got America's attention, got the world's attention. Now, if I were a terrorist planning that, this is what I would expect would happen. Initially, there would be an incredibly hostile reaction to this, and there was. A reaction that did not help the Arab cause. I'll tell you why. Just prior to the attack on the World Trade Center, on the Twin Towers, public opinion in the United States was finally moving in the direction of sympathy to the Palestinians. And after all, I'm not a great fan of Arabs and so on, but fair is fair. Palestine belonged to the Arabs, Christians and Muslims. It had been part of the Turkish Empire, and it was given to the British to rule as a mandate, as a protectorate, until such time as things could be sorted out, and that happened at Versailles in 1919. Okay, so political Zionism decided in 1898 at the Zionist Congress that they would marry the search for a homeland for Jews. Nationalism, of course, was very big in the 19th century, and nationalities wanted their own homeland, understandably. So France for the French, Germany, United Germany for the Germans, United Italy for the Italians, and so on. Okay. Jews, or many Jews, not all, many Jews wanted a homeland. And initially, a number of possibilities were discussed. And this is largely down the memory hole. For instance, Madagascar, a big island just off the coast, the east coast of Africa. Big island, not very heavily populated. Well, what about that? Well, there were people who said, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't we Jews go to Madagascar and make that our homeland? There was also discussion of Uganda. Uganda is tropical, could grow a lot of crops, was I wouldn't say unpopulated, there were blacks there, but relatively unpopulated, maybe a piece of Uganda. There was even discussion of Argentina, or part of the southern part of Argentina, and Patagonia. Good land, very, very sparsely populated. But beginning around 1898, as Lady Michelle Renouf has pointed out in a brilliant video she's done, if you'd like to get a DVD of that video, just contact me, paul@paulfromm.com. And she explains how it all came about. But what the Zionists then decided to do was to blend religion with the desire for a Jewish homeland. And they settled upon Israel. And they dreamt up this, what I believe and many people believe is an utterly bogus claim that they'd lived there since time immemorial. Well, a Jewish author pointed out about 30 years ago, Arthur Kessler, in the 13th tribe, most of today's Jews are not the Jews of the Bible. They are, in fact, the East European Jews were Khazars. It was a Turkic tribe
that converted to Judaism in the 8th century. And they are the ones who spread. In fact, most of the world's Jews today genetically or inherently no connection to the land of Israel, or the land of Palestine. So the claim was pretty iffy. The problem is, the land of Palestine was not empty anymore. Well, it never had been empty, but it certainly wasn't empty in the early years of the 20th century. There was happened to be people living there, a fairly large population of Palestinians, Christians, who were Christians Christians or Muslims. So Zionism, as it developed, was inherently developing a plan of conquest, that they would basically bull their way into land that belonged to other people and said, oh, this was ours historically. That's a very, very dangerous game. could Celts today, that are in Scotland and Wales and Ireland, say, you know, we were originally the population of Britain when the Romans invaded, and subsequently after that, the Anglo-Saxons from Germanic tribes invaded in the 5th century, and later in the 9th and 10th century, the Vikings. In 1066, the Norman French. So the Celts got moved to the hinterlands. Could they then say, we're going to come back into England and reclaim it, it's ours? Well, that's very, very dicey. Well, the claim of the European Jews to Israel, or Palestine really, was even more, dicey. And it leaves the question, well, what happens to the Palestinians? The British, of course, agonized over this. Okay, well, how did that come about, the Jews got their wish? Well, there is a very important piece of paper. It's one page long, typed, not a lot of typing on it. It's called the Balfour Declaration. Lord Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary, or Foreign Minister, or Minister of External Affairs, or Secretary of State, however you want to label it. And Lord Rothschild, in fact, this was a letter to Lord Rothschild. Lord Rothschild had asked for Her Majesty's, His Majesty's government promise that when the war was over and Germany, if Germany was defeated, that the British would be taking part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman or Turkish Empire were aligned with Austria-Hungary and Germany. Again, they were the Axis powers aligned against Russia, France, England, and the British Empire. Italy kept switching sides. So, okay, that was the makeup. 1916. Had been a very, very bad year for the Allied powers, for England, France, etc. They had suffered colossal defeats on the battlefield, and it was now clear to their military leaders that they would either lose the war or else they couldn't win it. They didn't have enough manpower, and they were being bled white. To say nothing of the financial destruction. So what to do? Well, this was where the crafty Lord Rothschild, who had an extremely powerful influence within the British government, said, if you promise us a Jewish homeland in Palestine, then we will get the United States into the war on the Allied side. This is it's not a
a big secret, but it's not very often talked about. This was the utter treachery. Rothschild, at one point, Jews had given considerable support to Imperial Germany. In fact, the Kaiser abdicated in 1918, and until he died in 1941 in Holland in exile, he strongly blamed the betrayal by German Jews for his having lost the war and lost his throne. Anyway, Lord Rothschild demanded that the British promise a homeland in Palestine when they won the war, and in return, he would maneuver America into the war. Now you might wonder, well, how could he do that? I mean, is that the sort of promise that they may take it seriously? Well, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, took it seriously. And so Balfour gave the Lord Rothschild this the Balfour Declaration, or promise, that Jews would be able to carve out a homeland within Palestine, provided the rights of the native Arab population, Christian and Muslim, were protected. That's a promise that's very problematic. Anyway, Lord Rothschild used a very extensive Jewish control, even then, of the American mass media to start whipping up a fury against Germany. There are more details that I'm going to leave out just to make the story fairly brief. But in 1916, Woodrow Wilson sought a second term, and he won it. And his slogan was, "He kept us out of war." The vast majority of Americans did not want to get involved in the war in Europe. There were many German Americans of recent German descent and Irish descent. Many of the Irish did not particularly like the British because they had occupied Ireland for 300 years. Many German Americans naturally felt nostalgic or sympathetic to their cousins across the water. So there was very little enthusiasm for war. In fact, quite a strong feeling against it. Americans had bitter memories of what all-out war was like, 50 years before. There'd been this catastrophic war between the states, or sometimes called the Civil War. And people had long memories of the wreckage. 600,000 Americans died. Young men mutilated at the prime of their lives, dead or coming back, physical wrecks for the rest of their lives. How did Wilson do this? Well, why did Wilson do this? Why would he want to, having run as the peace president and having kept America out of war for 2 years, well, why would he throw in? Well, there are these shadowy Jewish advisors like Colonel Howes, who were close to him and helped persuade him. In many ways, Colonel Howes was one of the idea men around Woodrow Wilson. There were up-and-coming lawyers like Felix Frankfurter, who would go on to become a Supreme Court judge. And, of course, there were the big Jewish banking interests on Wall Street, the Kuhns, the Loebs, Warburgs, the Lehmans, some of whom actually also would back the Russian Revolution, the Russian communists, a year later. Anyway, the press hooped up a lot of wild propaganda against Germany, and finally, in April of 1917, America entered the war on the Allied side. There's no simple answer as to why Imperial Germany and Austria-Hungary lost the First World War. I mean, there are several partial answers, but certainly a huge factor was the infusion, especially by 1918, because it took a while for America to arm, to train soldiers, to get them across the Atlantic, and to get the war material. But Germany was now facing the industrial might of the United States, plus the large pool of manpower. Okay, so that's the background to how Jews ended up with the State of Israel. There were more events, of course. Just because there was a promise didn't mean it happened overnight. And so there were some people in the British government that did not want to honor that promise. There were others like Lawrence of Arabia who felt that the Arabs had been betrayed. They'd been promised independence. Now, basically, foreigners, European people who lived in Europe, namely the Jews, were going to be given a chunk of Arab land. So it took a while. And again, I'm speeding over a number of details. But you say, okay, well, that's interesting, but what does that have to do with 9/11? Okay, I'm getting there. By 2001, the brutality on TV of the Israeli soldiers had made a big impact on American public opinion. And there was one picture of a father cowering. There's an Israeli soldier very close with his rifle pointed at him, and father's trying to protect his boy, his son, and you know, waving his hands like, don't shoot, don't shoot. And the Israeli soldier shoots and kills the kid, who's, I think, about 12 years old. This was a little bit much for most people, even if you weren't a big fan of the Arabs. It was hard to see Israel as it had been portrayed in propaganda for ever since its foundation, as this plucky little country surrounded by all these hostile Arabs, and so on. It was hard to match that picture. So anyway, what did 9/11 do? Well, 9/11, overnight, erased almost all that sympathy for the Palestinians, even though the Palestinians didn't do 9/11. And many people said, you know, who cares about the goddamn Arabs? We don't care if we blow them all up. Well, you know, that's not very intelligent, but that was the result of the outrage and what had happened at 9/11. All Arabs got blamed. By a good many people, like the sympathy for the Arab cause, particularly the Palestinian cause, really melted away. So I come back to, well, what was my reaction? Well, I thought, you know, this wasn't very smart. But that'd be predictable. You pull off a real outrage like this, there will be very strong negative reaction. So if the idea is to try to get more support, eventually win American public opinion away from support of Israel, then this was not a very smart move. Now, of course, you have to allow for the fact that sometimes people do things that are not very smart. So that also danced around in my brain. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it was what didn't happen. And I'll tell you what didn't happen. Nothing else. These four dramatic acts, the two planes crashing into the Twin Towers, whatever attack hit the Pentagon, the other plane that went amiss in the field in Pennsylvania, but nothing else. Now, any study of effective terrorist campaigns is that there has to be follow-up. Because the initial reaction to an outrage is that the nation unites and turns very much against the perpetrators. People will say, well, you know, let's nuke the Middle East, or you know, things like that. If you're going to wear down the the resolve, you have to be able to continue to hit the enemy with terrorism. And that's what the Irish Republican Army did. Another relatively successful, I underline relatively successful, terrorist groups. And all of this was, was common knowledge. Bunch of tacticians. And that immediately made me suspicious. Okay, on the surface it looks like it's the Arab terrorists who did this. But there's no follow-up. And, of course, immediately a lot of things began to come out that were very, very suspicious. Now, I'm not a demolitions expert, but a year or so later, David Irving had one of his real history conferences, and he had an Air Force demolition expert who said that the explosions at the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, this was controlled demolition, that the planes would not have knocked the buildings down. In fact, there are a number of examples of planes hitting buildings, including a couple of planes that have hit the Waldorf Astoria in the United States in New York, and they damage a floor, they wreck part of the wall. There's some damage, but it doesn't take the building down. So I immediately became suspicious. And that this was that the official story was not as we'd been told. So if you ask, well, okay, what do you think today? Well, there are people like Monica and Alfred Schaefer who are far, far more knowledgeable about this than me. But if you were to ask me, well, what do you think happened? What I think happened was that somebody, perhaps Al-Qaeda influenced terrorists, did in fact pull off the bombing. But the Israelis knew about that and either facilitated it or did not tell the Americans, foreseeing exactly the result that happened, which was outrage and anger at the Arabs and the Muslims in the Middle East, and a greater willingness to go to war for Israel. It has happened 2 years later with George Bush, led America into the war in Iraq, even though nobody ever suggested that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11. But part of the general anti-Arab and anti-Muslim feeling allowed a lot of Americans to think, well, he probably did. Well, he didn't. And in fact, Saddam Hussein was very much despised by Al-Qaeda because he was a whiskey-drinking, backsliding Muslim who sometimes liked to dress very much in Western garb. Anyway, those would be my views on 9/11. I'm going to take my musical break right now and kind of a change of pace. I'm going to play some tunes by Hank Williams Jr. Hank, of course, the son of the great Hank Williams Sr., who died all too young at age 29 when Hank Jr. was just a little boy. Hank got his singing start almost as a toddler, singing some of his father's songs to adoring fans. But as he grew older, he wanted to develop his own style, and he did. I guess you might call it country rock. And these are some songs by Hank Williams Jr. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me.
Electric guitar, rocking in my County and we poured in the blood of the Tennessee mare and the Tennessee stud. Now we got a little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse coat around the door. And I love the girl with the golden hair and the Tennessee stud loved the Tennessee mare. The Tennessee stud was long, he leaned the color of the sun and his eyes were green.
Paul Crowe. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time.